With us is Jim Teeterman, call sign N8IDS, and he is the chair with the Dayton Hamvention, and we just roped him right into this, didn't we, Jim?
Yes, you did, and a very good morning to all on the show. Very nice to do this, exciting thing for us to do. First year as general chair, 2 years as assistant chair, getting used to what we're doing, and we're extremely excited for this year's show, Ted.
Well, let me ask you a question. How long have you been involved, though, with the Dayton Hamvention?
Since 1991. I've been an amateur since 1986, but 1991 was my first year with Hamvention itself as a participant for either a committee or a chair position.
You know, it's amazing to watch the Dayton Hamvention because it's almost like, how can I say it, a well-oiled machine, but there's so many parts and pieces that it's difficult to it's difficult to view the whole thing without noticing the fact that you've got all these different people and all these different things that are all going on at the same time, like a bunch of gears inside of a clock.
Yep, that's about what it is, Ted. And what you got here, and I give them a little idea of what we've got. We have 58 committee members on 27 separate committees that are on there that work actually year-round. By the time Hamvention's over this year, we will start again at the end of July into August. The planning, we've already planned, of course, for some of the stuff next year, but that's when our meeting starts. So my duties don't really stop. We take about a month off after our appreciation dinner, where we show our appreciation to all our volunteers, which this year, by the way, numbers about 435, and it's growing.
Well, it takes probably every one of those people to make this happen and to keep it organized and to keep everything under control, because there's all sorts of unexpected things that happen during Hamvention.
That's correct. And what we do is we try to roll with everything that comes in. We plan the best we can. It's just like any other, as you said, well-oiled machine. Well, I look at this, Ted, as a bunch of ordinary people doing extraordinary tasks all year long.
Because it's a year-long project, really. It doesn't just happen during the days of the Dayton Hamvention. There's other things going on that have to be planned and work that's got to be done in advance.
Yes, sir, we do. And these plans, as they go forward, each one of the years that goes on, there's a learning process and there's a learning curve to a lot of the improvements that we want to do. And then again, we'll even get up to as much as, and I'll go into this a little bit later, what's happening right now. The people are still coming forward with ideas for us, but the ideas that you first have is what is your theme going to be and develop it into that. That idea then goes into what's available, who wants to come in and participate. And generally, like I said, it's ordinary people coming together. They have the ideas, they correlate, and it's amazing how well they work together. I am very blessed to have the committees and the volunteers I have this year.
Let me ask a question, and that is, are you up on the history of Dayton at all? I mean, do you go back very far, or do you remember, like, the beginnings of the early days of the Dayton Hamvention?
No, I don't. I don't have that much of it in there. As I said, my amateur days started back in the late 80s, or actually mid-80s, about that area there. But as I'm in my position and I talk with people, and you mentioned in our pre-broadcast talks here, Michael Coulter, he's a person that's been into a lot. And as you know, Michael and his history, I listen to folks like him and everybody around that tell me what was going on, the bad days and the good days. And as I was going through some of this history itself, I had the opportunity this year to get from one of the members a series of the programs. And they started, of course, 1952. Well, those years, the programs themselves were nothing but printed pieces of paper. Then they went into small booklets and into the size we now have today. And through those books, I got almost a complete set from 52 on through last year. Those are the books that I use for reference, as well as listening to the people that are talking about all this and what's been done in the past. It takes a little bit of time to do this, and fortunately, I have the time to do that. But when you say, do I know the history? My history starts, as I said, from 91 on forward, and that is not the developing years. The one that you want to talk to there would be like persons like Michael, who if we can get, I wish we could have had him here this morning, but he was indisposed to do stuff, so he could have talked more to what that was going on. But I like history, and it's going to go back. Can I go into one thing that really happened this year that's going to point to the history part of this?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, one of the things that happened was a gentleman up in northern Ohio contacted us through our information. Henry Maminsky was our media chair, and he passed along the person's name. And he said, can you contact this person? Yes, I did. What it was a person up there who was not the family of the award winner, but he wants to bring back the very first Amateur of the Year trophy to us from 1955. The name is still on there. The person is still listed in the program that got that award. And this year, what we're going to do is he's going to come down with that award. And I told him, please do not clean it up. Leave the patina on it. We are going to set it right next to Tim Duffy's, K3LR, who was the Amateur of the Year this year. And we're going to have those side-by-side at the presentation. And I'm the lucky guy that gets them to give that award and be able to have kind of like a little bit of a photo op with the very first one to the one 60 years later. So these are the kind of things that kind of excite me when you say about history. This is what we bring forward and see if we can't keep history with it. And that is going to be presented back to Dara and to Dayton Hamvention to be displayed up at our clubhouse. How about that?
There you go. You know, I think without the history part of any organization, especially an organization like, how would you want to say it? How would you describe the Dayton Hamvention has its own persona?
It does.
But the history of the Dayton Hamvention is part of the magic and part of the mystique that makes it something very, very unique. Now, if you take that history away, it's just a ham function, if that makes any sense at all.
It does. Yeah, and I think you're exactly right, because it goes back to what does it bring together? It doesn't really bring together just one group. It brings many, many interests together. And I think this, back in the early, early days, and if you go into some of the written history of Dayton Amateur Radio Association, and when it was first started by Mr. Willick, and of course Frank Schwab, W8OK, getting the first one going down at the Biltmore, this is where you start with that kind of stuff and said, who are those people and what were they trying to do? That is what the goal is, I think, for every single chair or anybody that has anything to do with Hamvention. That's their goal, whether they know it or not. And then when you start hearing the grumblings, oh, we're going to close. Oh, this is the last year. It always seems to come back up like a phoenix. and it's right here again every single year. So it's not that we boo-hoo the people that are talking that way. We have to go after that person. Well, I shouldn't say go after. That's kind of a real rough term. We want to inform those folks that it is because of the tradition. And one of the articles that came out, the latest QST, kind of points it up as well as saying, if you haven't been to Dayton, you haven't seen Hamvention or what ham radio can be at its best, Ed. That's the best way I can put it.
Well, you know, what's really, I think I want to say what's really cool is that this thing, this thing overshadows the facility that it's in. Because Hera Arena is not the greatest place in the world to do anything. You know, I mean, it's got its own set of problems and handicaps. But when the Hamvention is there, you don't even notice the arena.
Not really.
You know, it just disappears. It's Hamvention.
Right. Well, I think what it is, it's if you get past what it is, if you have any kind of a thing that you have had from the past, and you and I and both know that you'll always remember mostly the bad stuff instead of the good until you get in there, and as you said, you kind of get focused, what tunnel vision, I guess I could call it, to say, here's my interest. I want to go see this new product, or I want to see this new procedure, or I want to see what this is going on. And you don't notice what you're walking by to get there, and then you're focused on the person talking to you about your interest, because that's why you came. You might have come 30 miles, you might have come 3,000 miles. And that's what you have to do. This is where the concentration and the interest is, so you're very correct. You don't see all of what's going on. But if you walk in, even when I go up there before the show, and I'll walk into that place, and as soon as I get just the odor, if you want to put it that way, and it might not be the best way to say odor, but the smells and the sights bring back past years of what happened and what we're doing today with it. So in explaining it that way, maybe that might make more sense to some of the folks.
Well, you know, what you're talking about, though, is a friend of mine used to comment all the time. He would say, oh, man, he'd turn on, we have an old radio or something. That smells like an old radio station.
There you go.
You know, has that smell to it. You know, and it's true. Old radio stations, because of the tubes, everything was tubes.
Yep.
You know, and they have they put out a certain kind of scent in the air.
It's the ozone.
Yeah, well, it's that, and the way they combine with dust and everything else. I mean, it's just it's a radio smell, is what it is. You know,
yep.
Maybe somebody ought to produce an aerosol version of that. You could squirt it around your ham shack. You know, that's exactly. I mean, you've hit it right on the button or the nose or whatever. Let me ask this question though, from the standpoint of the Dayton Hamvention. Where does the bulk of the people, and I know you've got some folks come in from California, you got some coming in from Europe, probably South America, Africa, you got people coming in from everywhere. Where is the bulk of the people? How far out is it, or what, if you had to put a circle around Dayton, Dayton, Ohio, how far out would it stretch for the majority of people that attend?
The majority of the people, and I don't want to make enemies, or I don't want to make friends because of this. What my answer would be to that, because I don't have numbers in front of me, and I should have been more prepared to do that to find out. But I'm going to say that if you're going to count in, and let's break it down to where we have the people inside and outside, there are those different interests that I see, you're going to have a bigger concentration from the northeast, but the Sun Belt, below the Sun Belt and below the Rust Belt is where you're going to see most of them come in. And then the big interest then when you start swinging back out to the Texas, Arizona, California, and swing on up to the northern part of the states, northwest parts, that's where you're going to see it. But again, we're getting a lot of international people coming over.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a good concentration of that. That's why we've added international relations. We're going to have that up there, a special booth up by ARRL to handle that kind of a contingent. But that, to me, is kind of an answer that I really don't know if I can pinpoint to do that. I think what I ought to do is be better prepared to do that when we do our next podcast, broadcast, or if I talk with you up there this year, next month, maybe I'll have an answer for you.
You know, I was thinking that the driving range to come in, you know, for the average ham.
Okay, well, the driving range, you've had people that will be... you'll see all the license plates, and if you go out in the parking lot, and that's one of the things they do and take pictures, you'll have them from almost every state, but there's going to be a big concentration from the Texas, Oklahoma, many, many, Indiana, Michigan, of course, right here in Ohio, all that, we expect that, Pennsylvania, New York, down into the southern states, into the Carolinas. Of course, we got Mr. Medlin coming in with his, that he does his podcast all the way up and all the way back, and all the time he's out there. He kind of promotes that kind of stuff, and he'll probably see people coming up. So he'll bring a lot of people in from the Tennessee, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia area. So it's just all over the place. It's kind of a hard question to really put the exact number on, Ted.
Well, and the reason why I ask is because the comments that I get from people on email, I'm seeing, you know, North and South Carolina, very strong. Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, a lot of people from Tennessee and Kentucky, a lot of people from Alabama and Georgia. And then, of course, the Carolinas and then up the East Coast. I mean, I see emails coming in from people commenting about stuff all through the East Coast, from New York on up into Massachusetts. I mean, in Maine, people from Maine writing in, you know. So I'm kind of picturing a circle that stretches out, you know, probably about 800, 900 miles.
Easily.
Out of Dayton, which would be what I would consider not the people that fly in. These are people that just get in their car and make a trip out of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that is because I want to put a little peer pressure on the folks that aren't doing that. That are thinking, you know, hey, it's too far. I'm not going to go. You know, and I want you to think about something.
Sure.
The people who are listening, I'm sure you've gone to Dayton and you had a great time, and then the next year rolls around, and you know, as you get older, you begin to start thinking about all the things you've just got to get done, you know, these things. And especially retired people, my goodness, have they got the deadlines to meet. You know, it amazes me. I talk to folks that are retired. They go, oh, I just got to get this done by so-and-so, and done, and they got this imaginary deadline set and everything. And it's like, if you think about it, even if you have business-related projects, the year that you went to Dayton, did your business not survive? Did all your deadlines not get met after you got back? Mm-hmm. Did it even make a hill of beans difference that you were gone for a couple of days? You know, you need to take a couple of days and get away from everything. And if you're a ham or a shortwave listener, go to some place that you can get all your troubles off of your mind and walk through and just see things that you can drool over, okay?
That's a good way to put it, because to fortify that, my own experience of doing that is what you're talking about really is a commonly called the bucket list. And I had my own as well, did some traveling and all, and I found exactly what you said. While I was still working, I planned that whole week to do this once I got into my amateur activities and things like that, even before hamvention duty times. And what I found was I enjoyed so much going out at the flea market, not so much the inside stuff, because I was a person that wasn't involved with maybe modifying equipment or building antennas and stuff like that, so I was mostly out in the flea market. Well, then, when I got involved with hamvention itself, I don't see the show. And if somebody says, well, what do you mean? Here you are, you're the top dog this year, and you're talking about when you were and when you're working up to this, you didn't see the show. Believe me, it's busy enough, and you may have the same experience as yourself, Ted.
Oh, yeah.
You do not get to see the show the way you used to see the show, and that's what I miss. So the only advice I can give along the line of what we're talking about here is if you are going to come, and if this is the first few times or the very first times, keep your mind open on what you want to do. You may have had some idea why you came, but don't keep that as your complete focus. Look around, see who you're going to see, meet as many people as you can, go to the forums like if you have interest in them, but just walk around and keep your mind open. We are going to keep you safe. I'm not going to say try. We will keep you safe up here. That's our job. We want to keep you safe, happy, and I have tried to put in the order for dry weather. We'll see how that works, Ted.
There you go. Well, you know, the weather is a wild card, but mm-hmm. I've seen Dayton, the Dayton Hamvention survive when they have predicted rain for all 3 days. You know, it's going to be nothing but rain. And yet there were those, you know, it would rain a little bit, and then the guys would pull the tarps off and everybody would be back out in the flea market. And,
exactly.
You know, it'd rain a little bit and everybody go back inside and then they'd come back out again. So I've not been to one, maybe you have, a Dayton where it just was just nothing but rain and nobody could do anything. I've yet to see one of those situations.
I've seen that, but I've seen snow and they still go through it.
Okay, well, I've never seen snow. I guess I don't go back far enough. My first Dayton hamvention was, let me think. It'd be around 1977, I think, something like that.
Okay, you predate me.
But I didn't go I didn't go every year because I couldn't. I mean, with your job and everything, sometimes, especially with radio engineering, you're working weekends and whatnot, so I didn't get to go. But I think 77 was maybe one of the very first years that I remember going. And the thing was is that, you know, I think that without going to Dayton, I think that as a radio amateur, especially us fellas that get up a little bit for as age is concerned, you know, you kind of lose a little bit of your zest in regards to the magic and the sparkle of radio. And then when you go to Dayton Hamvention and you walk through the place and you see all the other hams and you see these guys wearing these crazy hats and, you know, you go through the flea market and you see stuff that you wonder why anyone would even bother hauling there. And then you see all these other things that wish you could buy every one of them, you know.
Sure.
There's a certain renewal that takes place. In other words, you come there, and when you leave, okay, the zest and the enthusiasm and the spark has come back. In other words, it takes that camaraderie, I guess, is the best word. Maybe that's it, you know. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. I'm Ted Randall, and our guest is Jim Teeterman. N8IDS, the chair of the Dayton Hamvention, will be back right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. Our guest is Jim Teeterman, N8IDS. He is the chairman of the Dayton Hamvention this year for 2015 and 2016. Let's get back to Jim. It takes that. And then visiting your old gear. Someone said that the flea market is where hams go and visit their old gear that they once had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that. I mean, I've watched these guys, they walk through and, you know, there was some friends, "Hey, look at that, I had one of those," you know. And so there's a magic that takes place there. And I think even if you didn't purchase one thing, you're going to take something back with you. And that is, you're going to feel a whole lot of a renewal. That spark will be back. Your enthusiasm will be higher. The Dayton Hamvention just does that to you. Does that make any sense at all?
It does make it sense, because as you're talking about this, I'm going back and reflecting on what I was talking about just a minute ago. Is when I first went out there, I'd come back home after all these golden things I'd bring home, and my wife would ask me, "Well, what'd you get?" and I would show her something. And if it was a little small box, but it cost me $300, she says, oh, okay. And I bring something out that cost me $3, and it was the size of a bread box. She says, oh, that looks interesting. So it's just perception of what it is I'm going to do with this stuff. But those days are the things that I think exactly what you said. I didn't know what I was going to find. So when I did find it, I had the enthusiasm to come back home and develop what I thought I was going to do to it, maybe even go on to a tangent, different direction, still exploring this stuff. And I'd like to expound a little bit on what you're saying. When you go through the flea market or even inside and you look at this, and some of the people say in a group and say, hey, guys, I remember when I worked one of this. If there's a younger person in that group, explain to that young person what that piece of equipment did then and see if they aren't interested. They're really, well, do you want to buy this and I can show you how to operate it? There is where you can be the Elmer all over again. See what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. That's yeah, Chris, I do that naturally. I actually probably go overboard, you know. But I'll tell you what else is really cool. If you go to Dayton and you're walking through the flea market and all of a sudden you look and you see a piece of homebrew gear.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
That you built and you don't remember where it went. And there it sits, you know. Mm-hmm. And you look at that and you say, boy, I wish I could just trace this thing.
Mm-hmm. Where has it been? It's like saying, I don't know if you've seen like the that one thing you used to be on I guess it was emails that come through, where has George been? It's where a dollar bill has been by a serial number.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd write in and tell who you were. Well, the same thing with history like that. So I'm glad you worked in our theme here, homebrew. This is one of the things that is continuing on from makers. And homebrew, and all the different things you want to go locally, we get into, there's a Thursday night group, and many other groups, but one is a Thursday night group up here at the Bell Fountain Clubhouse on Thursday evenings, and they're going into a lot of the different things that are handmade, brought up. Of course, they're all the Arduino and all the solid-state stuff and software-defined radio equipment, but it's still, in its own right, it's an exploratory experiment by people that are trying to figure out what to do with different things that are there. And along with that, this year, what we're going into is been brought to my interest and to my attention was mesh network, which I didn't know what that was until I was exposed to it. It's an interesting way of doing things as well. It's all communication, and it's all homebrew stuff. So going with that line, that's what we're trying to promote this year, Ted.
Okay, why don't you explain that? Because I don't have a clue as what you're talking about.
Oh, you don't?
No.
You've not heard of the mesh networks?
No.
Okay, well, what it came to my attention was there was a gentleman here that was into it here, Mr. Bill Curtis, and I, on the side, I do rotor repair and things of that sort, so he came to me wanting a rotor. And I said, well, what are you going to use it for? And he started explaining, and it was small antennas and what have you. And I said, well, what's this mesh network you're talking about? Well, what it is repurposing the routers that you use on Internet to do communications, and it's amazing what they can put on this, Ted. They can put video. They can put telephone. They can put radio communications. They can put these things together, and they put them more or less like in a little plastic box with a battery. They have their own antenna systems. They have these routers that do all this and connect to each other. So it's called a mesh because they find each other. And when they find each other in emergency communications, if everything were to drop, if the Internet was gone, the telephone lines are down, all power's gone, these are battery-powered pieces of equipment, and you can set these to where they are close enough to each other to link. And over those links, they can go to Internet if they need to, but they can be self-contained communication devices that can link. And they are trying out now to say if they went from a police station or emergency point up to, say, a hospital, a police department, an ARES-type thing if they want to do that. That's what it's all about. So we were dedicating one corner in East Hall strictly for the meshy, we call it Meshville, and Bill is heading this up. So best thing I can say is if you really want to learn, go see Bill and his group up there this year at Dayton.
You know, something I had proposed, I mentioned this on the air, this has been back years ago, I said, I don't understand why it is that hams, you know, and I'm launching into an area that I don't even know what I'm talking about. Why hams could not put together something like the internet that would run totally independently of the internet, strictly for experimentation, emergency communications, and all of this. And it would be, you know, so if the internet goes down, we've still got, you know, because obviously if you had connections between hams, that's going to be a lot more manageable, I guess I want to say, during an emergency rather than a commercial operation where you've got, you know, paid employees out in trucks trying to repair things. If it's point to point from ham to ham and whatnot, and the whole thing connects together to form this thing that's similar to the internet. Now, see, once again, I'm saying something I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well,
but I mean, it's that imagination, you know. So it sounds to me like this right here, what you're talking about. They've already got this going. They've already started on this. You know?
Well, yes. Well, as I understand from the history of it from Bill, this was very popular in Germany because, and I imagine it's because of some of the hilly areas out there where you, again, if you get down into the hilly areas of the southeast and where you can't get communications in mountains and things like that, this is what it was developed over. Well, this exactly, you had a very good description of what can be done communication-wise, if that goes down. They may not be able to get the internet per se itself, but if they were able to have internet from an outside source that is in the unaffected area that surrounds the affected area, they can bring that internet in, which so many people depend on internet functions for daily life. But less that, not having the internet itself, you still have telephone communications, video communications, things of that sort that you can, that are tantamount to getting emergency traffic back. You and I both know that's exactly what hams do. That's what we're really touted for, is in emergencies, a ham can get through. This is what this whole thing is. So I'm saying that the best thing I could do for you this year is get Bill Curtis up to your booth and explain this.
There you go. That sounds really good. I want to switch gears just a little bit here.
Sure, go ahead.
I want you, if you would, to kind of relate to me the story of how you got into ham radio. What was it that sparked your interest? What was the very first thing you ever knew that there was such a thing as ham radio?
Okay, well, I'll go back to a person, Mr. Richard Brown, N8IBV, who is a silent key now, sorrowfully, but he came to me as a friend, and we were on, and I'll say it right out, and I'll admit it, the 11-meter band is where I learned things. But where his interests were, number one, shortwave listening. When he was a teenager in Illinois, he and his brother both were into amateur radio. When I met Richard, it was through, again, the work that we were doing and this flea market searches that we did back before I became licensed, and that was about 1979, 1980 in that area. We would sit there and build things, and Dick and I would be designing stuff, and he got me into antennas and things of that sort, which I liked using my hands. So that was the interest. About 3 years into this, he drove down the house. We were talking. He said, "We are going up to DPNL. You and I and Gary Markham, his nephew, and myself." He said, "We're going up to take our ham classes." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you are ready to go into the next step." So he went down with me. Gary went down. We started our classes at DPNL. We started working, got our licenses, really wanted this. So when it took off, my interest stayed with the UHF, VHF part of it, because we were always on sideband. We went to 2 meters. We went to 6 meters. Dick's big love was 6 meters. He can sit there and pop off all these people that have been on 6 meters since the beginnings, way back in the 20s, 30s, and especially the 40s. He and his brother were airplane spotters out in Illinois, so he got to know the different things about that. He was a history buff. So when I got started, I was very fortunate to have Richard as the mentor and the guide through all this stuff. Till my interest took off, into the building of antennas, not so much the modifications of radios that much, but just how do we communicate. The important part of what an amateur station is, to me, it's the antenna. It's what's bringing the signal in and what's transmitting it out. So we went from there, and we started to get into clubs or two here locally, got to be members of those clubs, helped out what we could do there. Then it waned off and went back over to just talking back. But we talked every single night, 365 days a year. Never did a day go by that we didn't have 2-meter, 6-meter, whatever, experimenting or communication. So that was thanks to Richard where I got into it. Then along came Hamvention. Well, when that started, I got into with security mostly. Then I got into the communications where all the people use the radios to communicate throughout the complex throughout the weekend. Well, that's when I got to thinking, well, my radio career more or less helped me understand what we were doing and what's going on here, but what does Hamvention do for amateur radio? Well, that's when I got interested into how do we make this something that everybody can come to and have fun. And again, as I said just previously, I never got to see the show after I started with Hamvention. I never got to do those great old flea market searches and the inside looking at the new product stuff. It was just a very, very neat time of my life. I also, along the line, got to be very good friends of people that were actually the then owners of Drake Radio. When the Drake family sold out, there were three gentlemen that bought out there, and two of those people are very good friends to this day with me. And they were kind enough to share their experiences of what was going on. So there is where some of my history comes and on up through. So again, up through the early 90s is when I got it with Hamvention. So it's kind of absorbed that. My amateur stuff right now kind of is into, I've gotten into 220 mostly, but I'm 2 meters, 6 meters, a little bit of HF, locally, not long distance and all that kind of stuff, and then now into 220. So that brings us up to today. I know it's a very short rendition of the time from, say, 79 on up, but that one person, Mr. Richard Brown, he is responsible for me sitting here talking to you today.
Well, yeah, I get a lot of folks come up to our booth and people that write and say that this radio show has been the catalyst of them getting a ham license. They would write and say, hey, just got the ham license. I want to thank you. This is, I'm thinking to myself, all we do is get on here and run our mouth,
That's fine, but congratulations to you for that, and please keep it up.
But it's so amazing because you sit here, like where you're at right now, I mean, you have no idea who's hearing your voice. You have no idea where it's going, and you don't have any idea what kind of an influence you're going to be on someone else, And, of course, as the hobby grows, everybody benefits from it. But you were talking, let me say this. I mean, I hear this all the time, and I'm going to scold you for this. I don't like it when people say, I came up through Citizens Band. Let me tell you something. Here's what I think. I think Citizens Band is the other area where you could find potential ham radio operators, people who want to get the license. Now, I'm not talking about the people that are on there that just riffraff and they're, it's so easy to buy a radio, stick an antenna on it. So you get all kinds of people on there. There's truck drivers going down the road that are just excellent people that that love just tinkering with the radios, Now, when I was younger, I was in the Citizens Band way before ham, and at that time, that's a long story, but nonetheless, I was running radios like the old Citiphone SS and the Courier 23 and the Comstat 25 that Lafayette made, and the what was the other one? The Cobra Cam 88, and then there was a company out in Scotts Bluff, I think it was Nebraska. I'm trying to think where they were. Anyhow, they made these this whole line of linear amplifiers that ran on sweep tubes. They had the Hornet, the Raider, the Maverick, and the Phantom. The Phantom was this big 12-tube thing that had in stages. Actually, they had stages of amplification, but there were so many sweep tubes in this thing, and it was a television interference It was incredible. I mean, you could wipe television out for miles in your neighborhood if you had one of those things, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, you know, of course, everybody was buying beams and these polar diversity loops. What do they call those things? Somebody made this thing called a polar. It looked like a quad, but it had dual polarization on it. I don't know. But anyways, it was all skip talking. You know, these guys are wanting to talk. I mean, just across the country. They got the biggest bang out of hearing a station answer them. You know, they'd spend thousands of dollars to get on the 11-meter band to hear some guy say, oh, yeah, you're coming in here, for, you know, treetop tall or whatever they give them. So you're, you know, and you'd only talk 600 miles or so, maybe 1,000. You know, they weren't working overseas DX. It was just all, you know, skip land was the United States.
Everybody.
And then they started, of course, during the time that I was in it, it was all 23-channel crystal control radio. The regulations stipulated that channel 1 through 8, you could only talk to your own licensed units. So that would be when you applied for the CB license, you'd put down how many units you thought you'd have. I think the limit was 4. I'm not sure. Anyway, so it would be your call sign, you know, unit 1 to unit 3 or whatever on channel 1 through 8, then channel 9, I believe it was through 14, on those channels, you could talk to other people with other call signs. So if someone else had applied for a license, you could talk to them. And then from channel 15 through 22, you were back on this thing where you were only to talk to your own units. And channel 23 was open, so you could talk to other people.
When did Channel 9 become the emergency channel then?
You know, I don't know. I remember that started a long time ago with this group called REACT or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really knew, I mean, from the standpoint that it was an emergency channel, was it like ever declared an emergency channel by the FCC? Or is this just something that people started? I don't know. It's almost like, you know, Channel 19 for the truckers. I mean, it's not anything formal. It's just...
They did it.
Yeah, everybody wound up on 19.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, the Citizens Band community on the air was a different breed of animal from what I hear today. When I flip on Citizens Band today, you know, there's stuff that make a ball-headed man's hair curl. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like, what in the world? You know? Back then, though, people got together. They had these things called coffee breaks.
Yep. Used to do it.
And, you know, there'd be somebody that was sick or somebody that had a problem. And these guys would all come together, and they'd donate money. There usually was a band, and usually the cigarette smoke was so thick you couldn't breathe. You know, eyes would burn when you come out. And but these guys had a good time. Everything was very, very good-natured. And I saw then, I said, there's a need for this. Because every one of these people were renegades. Everybody used a handle on the air.
Yep.
Nobody used call signs. And I got to thinking about this. I thought, this is stupid. Why is it that our government has this thing so regulated that the people of the United States can't use it? Doesn't make sense, you know?
Yep.
And, of course, what happened was it just got people took over and said, heck with it. They threw the tea off the boat, and they said, we're going to do it our way.
Yep, and it really expounded out from that because even when you started doing that and you did the so-called uppers, when you started modifying, well, there's what my interest came into, Ted, was to take the radio that I had, and again, along with Richard and Gary, we would experiment with this kind of stuff, putting sliders in it to be able to clarify it up and down between channel stuff, learning what the channels meant, where were the frequencies at, where could you go, how did you make this radio do that, how could you make the phase lock loop still work. This is the kind of things that you were curious about, thought was absolute magic when you started. But when you started to work on it and figured out what the circuitry was, the theory behind it, do some reading, Dick was a big person. Get in there and read a book. Read a book. Read a book. That was what he would say. I would ask him how to do it, and he said, well, this book tells you how to do it. He wouldn't come out and tell me how to do it. Frustrating? Yeah. But was it a learning experience? You bet. It was that kind of thing now. That's what I miss today. I'm an administrator, more or less, but right now I still have the interest in doing things, and that's why I go back right now. I do my rotor control stuff because that's my relief time, my whatever you want to call it, my decompression from everything else I do here, I get out there and start tinkering with my hands and rebuilding a rotor and figuring out how this works and why don't I do that. And very good friends with Craig Henderson up there, Cats, who a lot of people know when it comes to rotor work. It's just a nice thing I can still keep in the hobby, but the connection I have here, and this is a wonderful opportunity you're giving me this morning, and I thank you again for doing this, is to be able to come out and say, this is the person that is trying to give you the best experience you can when you come to Dayton, no matter if it's this year, next year, or past years, or future years, is enjoy the experience and do what you want. Think about what you're doing. And maybe once I get past my chairmanship, I'll be able to relax a little bit. Maybe. Maybe I'll get back into something like that. I don't know, but I will stay involved. I've made the promise to my assistant chair, who is Mr. Ron Kramer, and he will be coming up behind me, and he's doing a great job being the assistant. So I want to support him as well to do this kind of thing. And some people say, well, boy, you got a gift for gab and stuff like that. Well, that's part of my talent. It's part of your talent. This is why we're here today. And this helps. I think it helps everything, is promoting what we're doing. But along with promoting it, we believe it. I think you and I, in our own way, believe in what we're doing. Do we not?
Oh, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. I'm Ted Randall, and our guest is Jim Teeterman, N8IDS, the chair of the Dayton Hamvention. We'll be back right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either, there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. Our guest is Jim Teeterman, N8IDS. He is the chairman of the Dayton Hamvention this year for 2015 and 2016. Let's get back to Jim. Absolutely. I mean, I can testify to this. One of the reasons why we do QSO, or why it's on the air, is because I went through, and I mean, I don't mind saying this on the air, it's a personal thing, but I went through, a pretty devastating situation, and I wound up with two sons, raising them as a single parent. And I went through all sorts of custody battles and all these things. A lot of folks go through that. A lot of people face that. And but what it did is it just drained me financially. I mean, I was left. I mean, you can go through. Lawyers know how to vacuum money. You know, they know how. They just know how to do that. You know.
Okay, I'll give you that. Yeah.
And Well, out on the other side, I got to thinking. I thought, what do I do? I got these two kids I can't afford. Now I cannot afford even thinking about putting them through college. What do I do? So, you know what? I started leaving books around for them. You know, QST, other magazines and stuff. I'd bring in a piece of radio gear and set on the table and say, come on over here and give me a hand with this, you know. And we start tinkering and whatnot, pulling antennas up into trees. Well, the next thing you know, they're wanting to get their ham tickets. Now, I didn't push them. They just were enticed into the hobby like any other normal person that gets exposed to it. The big problem is getting exposed, you know. And there's a lot of folks out there that have a predisposition against anything like ham radio because it's too nerdy. It's too, you know. Of course, now the age of the computer has changed an awful lot of that.
Yes, it has.
But by the same token, it's okay to have your kids involved in baseball and Little League this and all this stuff. But why not amateur radio? See, I mean, it seems like it becomes very one-sided. So what can happen if they are exposed to amateur radio? Well, they got their ham tickets. And not only did they get their ham tickets, but I went to work for, I'll tell you, I just went to work for Cumulus here in Nashville. And my one son, Matt, went to work with me. Now, David was already working, and I can't remember where he was at. He was at a radio job doing radio stuff. And Matt came with me to work, and he was starting to work on computers and IT stuff. And I told him when they hired me, I said, look, I'm bringing my son with me every day. Hey, why don't you try that, Dad? You know, I'm talking to all these dads out there. Why don't you try that? You know, you may be in a position to do that. Ask your boss, can I bring my kid with me? Can I teach him what I'm doing? You know, of course, it's unheard of. It's improper. It's an IT violation. Oh, no, HR violation here. Yeah. So I'm working with him, and all of a sudden, Michael Dickey, who is one of the Dickey brothers that are the owners of Cumulus, which is the second largest broadcast chain in the U.S.,
okay,
he calls Matt in his office. First, he asked me, he said, would you mind if I hire him? I said, not at all. I said, I'll lose an assistant. Oh, no. He said, he can work with you, but I want to put him on the payroll, and I want him to do stuff for us.
Mm.
You know, so this is where ham radio takes you. Mm-hmm. You see, ham radio can take you into areas like that. So he went to work for Cumulus. And, of course, after Cumulus, I'm trying to think. Well, anyways, right now he's the chief engineer for the Dave Ramsey Show, which is probably that's the largest independent syndicated radio show probably in the whole world.
Mm.
And they have beautiful, huge headquarters out in Brentwood, Tennessee. Now, you know, think about I'm sorry, Franklin. The thing, you know, I get ahead of myself sometimes when I'm talking. That's a weird phenomenon. I look at this and I say to myself, okay, this is what can happen. This is what can happen. Here's a kid that didn't get to go to college, all right? And he was at Ramsey, though they were making fun about how young he was while he was there, you know. And
okay.
I see this, and my other son David now is at Trevecca Nazarene University, does all of the video and audio, all their ball games and all the public relations stuff, and he takes care of their radio. There's two or three radio transmitters involved in their operation over there, and the tower and whatnot. He takes care of all of that. All of this came out of pulling antennas up into trees. It came out of tinkering and hooking things up, and now it doesn't work. Why not? You know, and the magic of that, and going to the Dayton Hamvention every year, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This has been, I want to say, the catalyst, and we're not unique. We're not unique in any way, shape, or form. We're just like anybody else. And I'm just saying that if parents that you wonder how do you keep your kid from doing this and doing that, and you can't figure out why it is that they seem to wind up either getting in trouble or losing interest in things. You know, have you ever tried? You ever thought about including them in something involving amateur radio?
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, and it's important to do. Now we have two daughters grown now. One's in Atlanta. One's here in Dayton. And they got into, my oldest, Carrie, got into the nursing trade or into the nursing fields and into microbiology. And her mother's been a nurse She was a nurse for 50 years. And the youngest one's a phlebotomist in the emergency room in the local hospital. And when they watched me do what I was doing, I was trying to do some of what you were talking about. Would you girls like to learn what to do here? Dad, you're crazy. It's they would go by, and back when Carrie would call home, and she says, are you on your Halo station? I said, what do you mean, my Halo station? She said, well, when you were sitting there testing your radios on your little station, when you started out, you kept on going, Halo, Halo, Halo. I said, well, haven't you ever been curious about what it is to who you could talk to if you didn't even know who that person was? She says, no, I don't want to do that. So, again, I didn't force the girls at all. But here in this area, there are several young ladies, quite a few. One I'm quite familiar with and know quite well is Christy Crawford, who is now in Ohio State, but a very good friend of mine, Mike Crawford, who is the head of the head of communications committee for us. And it was nice to see her develop into the amateur she is. When I first met her, she was quite a little bit younger. Now she's a growing young lady in college, still using her amateur talents. And this is what, going along the line of what you're saying with your sons. They're using something, yet they're still going in to do something else in college itself, but they'll always have that hobby. They'll always have something else to fall back on of what do I do now? Well, I can turn my radio on. I can go talk with somebody. Or if I'm on to contact somebody in the long distance or something like that, and if we move, or if I move away from home, I can call home, not with the cell phone. I can talk with Dad on HF. There's a good part of it for young people right there. As far as I feel that that's what you need to have, Ted, just what you're talking about.
Well, I think it would be rough. I think it would be rough trying to get daughters involved in ham radio. Now, the only reason why is, you know, the female wants to do female kind of things. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, they're into, what, fingernail polish and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's just the way they are.
You know? But don't discount the ones that already have their calls.
Well, no. I'm saying that I'm sure there's some, but I think it'd be much more difficult to lead a girl, you know, your daughter or whatnot, into the amateur radio field. A lot more difficult, I think.
And I go back to Mike and Christy. Christy's mother died early, and Mike is remarried. Janice, very nice young lady, and they get along quite well. So it was very close between Mike and Christy to do this. So this was what Mike does. Mike is dedicated to amateur radio. He has a very good job in there in what he does is for his living. But radio and hamvention, it comes around to where he does a lot of public service thing. That's another thing that he got me into. If you will see on our site and take a look at what we have, the new Dara van. Well, Mike was the catalyst by taking the older, what they call a Dara ambulance, which was an old ambulance that they had. That was the communication vehicle for Dara for a while after they had the Smurf mobile, the great big blue thing. Well, now it's into a 32-foot white, I think it's a white. I don't even know what the heck it is, to be honest with you. Just a big white van, but it was a Mack tool truck. And it was converted by a local company over in Jamestown. And I was lucky enough to be able to be on the van crew, not the development of the thing or the building it so much, but to crew it when it goes out on some of these visits that we go to. Well, we're doing a lot of it. We do the Air Force Marathon is one of the larger things we do this year, every year in September. We have both the X-Warn trailer tied up with the Dara van. One of them handles the medical part. The other's logistics part. I get to do the coordination of those two parts there. But the teams that we have all come from the clubs that are supporting and do hamvention stuff. That's how we got to know each other. We know each other as a family. And many, many of these people that are helping us are the children and the young adults of our families, Ted. So it still comes out to community stuff.
Well, you know, I was going to say on another page in regards to amateur radio and professional electronics jobs. And let's say that you are you could be an X-ray technician. You could be, you could do repair work on hospital equipment. You know, there's a number of, all kinds of things today. You could be in the IT world. You could be responsible for actually repairing routers and things, or building and designing them. here's something I found out real interesting that I can relate from the broadcast industry. If you've ever built, and this goes down your line too, if you've ever built antennas, designed them, or tried to, you know, maybe design might not be the right word, but just try to concoct one, okay?
Better word, I think, yeah.
And you're trying to find something that really works. Well, one of the things that I found as a young person, and I know both of my sons working with, you know, experimenting with antennas, we found out one thing. There's two different things here. You can match just about anything. You can get just a pair of bed springs. You can drive nails in a tree, you know, and take an antenna tuner and tune it up.
Yep.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to radiate, you know, well. And in the broadcast arena, here's one thing I found about broadcast technicians. They know how to make the antenna at, you know, 50 ohms at the termination point.
Yep.
But they don't know necessarily how to tweak it to make it radiate. And one of the things that we found was this magic word called resonance. You know, and when the antenna is the right length, and then it's also matched, all of a sudden it like dissipates into the ether. You know, it like joins the heavens and becomes they become one. You know, and the thing works. Well, you'll see these broadcast companies will put antennas out that are tuned, say, on the FM band. Let's say you're transmitting at 100.1 on the FM band. They'll come up with an antenna that if you sweep it, it's actually tuned to like 103.5. And they'll use some sort of device to match it to 50 ohms. And then they give you this blank stare as if, oh, something wrong? Okay. And you can't tell them anything because they already wrote the book on it.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So one thing that has helped in our arena is, generally speaking, if you've been in ham radio and you've worked on antennas, you've worked on, you will generally have the edge over someone who has just learned out of a textbook.
Yep, that's what I'm saying. Going back to the books.
I mean,
correct. Yeah.
If you can read it in the book and you think you understand it, but how many times have you built something out of the book and it didn't work?
Well, there you hit on something right there that was near and dear to my heart. Again, going back to Richard. He said, I've got this article I want you to read. And I didn't know what it was. And it was his optimizing 2 and 6 meter antennas. I said, okay. And again, I go back to, this is my 2 meter and 6 meter days. He said, let's develop the 2 meter one first. And I want you to start with a dipole. I said, okay. And he didn't give me anything else but that. And he said, just start reading this. Now, he lived north up in Vandalia. I lived down in Centerville, which were not that many miles apart, but, you know, it takes a concentrated effort to go up if I'm on the visit. So here we are reading the book. He says, start with the dipole, and we'll start there. And I want you to put a field strength meter out there, and just what you're saying, if it comes out to be mathematically what I thought it was supposed to be, and it didn't, the field strength meter was going to tell the story. So he taught me about element diameters, element spacing, what the driven element to the reflector, to the reflector, to the back element, you know, my terms mixed up here. But then as you started putting drivers, driven elements on in front of it, how everything changed to going to what you said. If it's supposed to be resonant, say, at 144-200 sideband, and the darn thing sitting up there about 145-something, what happened? Well, then you go back in and start finding out what happened, and sure enough, you're going to find an answer. You feel so much better about developing that antenna that I had a 14-foot, inch-and-a-quarter boom, 2-meter antenna that had 8 elements that outperformed a 17-element commercial antenna when it came to forward gain, a just all-around performance. Made me feel so darn good that I did that. Still had the plans for it, but it was because Richard said, go read that book. So that's a part again. I don't get into that anymore. I probably could if I got back into it and have some fun. Still have the aluminum, still have the antenna. Still like playing around, but now I have a rotor I need to build to put on top of the tower to put it up there within.
Can you imagine, though, how much fun we could have had building antennas back in the early days had we had an MFJ antenna analyzer.
Oh, well, have you ever used a noise bridge?
Yes, I have. Okay. I've got an old Heath kit sitting here.
Yep, that was what I got into with Richard. We got into that little battery-powered thing, and, of course, a lot of people make a mistake of transmitting into it, and there went the SCRs. You had to replace that. But that was my first experience at learning how to do it. Then the FMFJ come along, and I had to have one. Had to have one. Well, and you know, as good as that is, and I don't want to be bad-mouthed or anything, as good as those are, there are still areas that you still have to do your own tweaking on this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's like I said in the book. I know this has happened a lot to me with projects where you see a schematic and the parts list, and you order the parts list, and you start building this thing, and you read all the text a million times, you know, mm-hmm. and you get through it, and you turn it on. It just doesn't work, mm-hmm. you know. And it's because there's areas inside the text or inside, I guess I want to say, there's things that they can't print every variable for you.
No, they can't know every geographic location. They don't know where you've got this mounted. They don't know what kind of coax you've got. They try to lead you down to say, if you want to tune your coax along with it, you can do that, but that's not the best step.
But it's so interesting, though, and I talk to folks. I know we're off the beaten path from Dayton, but not really.
No, it's along the same line. We'll get into it again.
What I was going to say is I tell people, have you ever went over to a piano and pushed the sustain pedal down and sang a note? Doesn't matter what note you sing, you sing a note. And that one set of strings for that particular note will vibrate back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear that. And if you go over to the piano and take some felt and stick it, you know, in between those strings to keep them from vibrating, and then sing that note again, and there's no sound. That doesn't sing back, you know. So then you pull the felt out, you sing a different note, and that particular set of strings for that note will resound back to you. So that's this thing called resonance. And it's like nobody seems to, you know, in our commercial broadcast arena, it's like nobody gets this. It's like this is an a forgotten thing. Now, true. If you go to center feed a quarter wave on each side, you know, you wind up at about 50 ohms. Just that's about, I mean, just about what it is, you know. But there's all sorts, like you said, there's other variables involved in this. If you want to really get to the resonant point of an antenna, you've got to consider how far it is off the ground. You've got, you know, and you start trimming the ends. Oh, man, one telling thing is inverted Vs that have mm-hmm. low ends that come down toward the ground.
Yep, that's what I use.
And you start trimming those so you get the your 50 ohms and you get minimum standing wave. You can take that same antenna, uproot it, and set it across town somewhere, and it will not be tuned like it was in its first location. You know?
That's why you leave an extra 4 feet on the end.
So then you say to yourself, what causes this? Mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, we just know the reality of it is what it is.
Yep.
But when you get to resonance and then you're matched into your transmitter, then it's an amazing difference. And you can really experiment with mobile antennas and see this in action.
Yep. That's one thing I got into, too, was, again, I go back to Richard. He said, let's try this little antenna. It was about 12:30 at night. We're sitting there playing with this thing. And he said, go build this. So the next night, I had this thing. It was a 19-inch pieces of rigid rod. I think they were just steel. And I put them on a fiberglass, old CB antenna, fiberglass up 19 inches above the mag mount. Sitting on my floor at the house here, hooked it up to my 2-meter radio and talking to him up in Vandalia on 1 watt. So it was a horizontal. We always went horizontal. And the resonance of that was made by moving it in and out, the degree, you know, the spread of the elements themselves. The length didn't seem to make a lot of difference. So here again we learned how far above the vehicle it had to be. What vehicle is it on? I had a van at the time. Of course, the center of the top is going to be optimum. So I learned by putting it in the front, the pattern would be different off the vehicle as I turn in a circle. So I go out in a circle in the parking lot. Dick is up there listening to me, telling me my signal strength, and I put it on the back of the car and go in the same circle. Playing around like that, I miss that. I miss that kind of stuff. we are kind of digressing here, but you kind of bring me back to my... you asked the question, where did I come from? There it is.
Well, see, the thing of it is in how do I tie this to Dayton? It's so simple. When you're walking through that flea market, you'll get in discussions with guys that have learned hands-on something you don't know.
That's correct.
And you'll walk a little further down, and you'll see a guy with a table with this stuff on. Oh, you play with this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get into another conversation, and now you find out something else that you didn't know. And this guy didn't get it out of a book. He got the ideas out of the book, but he actually learned what he learned by hands-on.
Yes.
You know?
And the next thing you did there, right along with that, Ted, not only did you learn something technically, what's the next thing you did? You actually went up and introduced yourself to somebody you had never seen in your life before.
Oh, yeah.
See, there is the part of Dayton that I love the best.
Well, you know, though, now think about this. At the Dayton Hamvention, when you're walking around the flea market, it's like you already know these people.
Somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, in some degrees, maybe not. But, I mean, you're very much at ease walking up and talking to folks. And I guess for someone like myself or someone like you, you don't even think about it. But for other people are very, very timid. I mean, a lot of folks, they don't feel comfortable walking up and talking to a stranger.
No. Well, what's the first thing you do to get them to break the ice? You smile. You don't have a grumpy face, you smile. And then it's good morning, good afternoon, whatever. And if they're astute at what's going on, they look down at the badge that we wear, because everybody, of course, on committee, and look for the yellow shirts this year. It was my wife's choice of colors, by the way.
Uh-huh.
You look at that committee badge. You may or may not recognize the call, but on there will be the committee they are and their position. It doesn't make any difference to me who you are when it has that badge. Talk to those people. Let them know what your feelings are. What are your needs? I don't care if you just like the most common. What do you think the most common question is, Ted?
I have no idea.
Where's the nearest restroom?
Okay, I guess it would be.
It always goes up to something. But anyway, just knowing that, as you're saying, going through any part of Hamvention, I'll agree that inside is a little more... The people are a little more concentrated and focused on what's going on in there because there's so much to see. There is the same thing out there, but it's a little more open out in the flea market. Little more open. You have a little more free range. Somebody are trying to rope you into talking this or that, but it's your choice. It's your choice. So, again, keep that open mind. Try to be as cheerful as you possibly can. We're always going to have some things that don't work out quite the way you want that day, but that's what we're there for, is to try to make that visit as comfortable as you can, help you as much as you can. But again, I can't say that our committees are going to be able to help it. You have to put a little effort into it. I'm talking now to the attendees. Look at the effort you're doing. Look what you're doing yourself. You're trying to bring in people to come first, because you're telling me you have no problem with people coming up there, and you probably have no problem filling up your whole day of broadcast. Am I correct?
Oh, no. It's continuous, and, you know, let me just say this. There's times I miss the flea market, not because I'm looking for stuff to buy. I just miss going out there, seeing all the equipment, and just talking to the people and asking questions and having conversations about things that maybe I have never been able to get. You know, I'm stuck at that booth. I mean, I'm on the air from the time we get there till the time we leave, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm one of the ones that they're yelling at to get off the property or get out of there because it's over for the day.
Oh, you are. Yeah. Are you one of those guys that wants to hang on?
Yeah, it's like, you know, and I come up with some real good stuff and tell them as to why I have to be there. But anyways... Anyhow, but no, because I feel deprived, you know, I get off the air and say, I wanted to go see that, you know, and of course, there you go, you go out to the flea market, and then the tarps are all over everything, and you're like, oh,
yeah.
But
yeah.
If you walk around a little bit, there's those renegades that don't put the tarps on right away, you know,
nope.
And you can find those guys, you know, and they've got tables full of stuff that's interesting, too, so.
Yeah, but don't take that tarp up if it's tied down. Boy, they'll get possessive, won't they?
I wouldn't do that because I'm afraid I'd break something.
You know? You are. Then you bought it.
you will find that when you're at the Dayton Hamvention, you can track people down that are working there that are volunteers and whatnot.
Yep. Yep.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to know everything.
No, they aren't. Yeah. But they have one thing on their hip, and most of them will have. They'll have that radio that will go back to the communication trailer to get you more than likely to the person who's going to be able to help you. Again, I stress, we need to be able to help people if they're there. If they're there for their 100th time, maybe not the 100th, but I would hope, well, we couldn't be 100, could we? But anyway, for as many times as you could be there, maximum to the first time. We stress, be helpful, be cheerful, do what you can, whatever the situation comes up to do it. If it has to come up to me to do it, that's what we'll do. I'm just one of those guys out there with a yellow shirt during that weekend. Yeah, when we're working up to this, I'm the guy that goes to the go-to for most answers, but then I put it right back on the people that are committee chairs. They have the responsibility of getting whatever they're responsible for done. I can't do that. I am not the do-all guy. I was just picked, very fortunately, to put this position together, in this position to be able to guide them a little bit on stuff and say, give the okay or the no, the nay or the yay, to go ahead and do something if we think it's new or old or just needs to be done. But again, stressing, those people in the yellow shirts, those are the ones that we have picked to go out and help everybody do what it is. And on the inside exhibits, I might mention this. The inside exhibits headed up by Brian Markland again this year, the people that are wearing, along with the yellow shirts, they'll have red vests on. Those red vest people are the ones that are helping the inside exhibitors to do what they need, but that doesn't mean that they can't help just the general attendee as well. So, again, help the people that are there. That's what we're there for, Ted.
Part of what goes on at Dayton, and there's a number of things. There are those programs or the forums.
Forums, yep.
And those are on all kinds of subjects.
Yes.
I remember one year, and I missed it, I wanted to go, the fellow that was managing this project up, I guess it's in Alaska, HARP.
That
everybody, it's been a very controversial thing. I mean, you know, on the Art Bell Show, they talked about how it's changing the weather and it's messing around with brainwaves. Oh, man, I'm telling you what, you know. But this guy was there one year, and I missed it. I wanted to go because I wanted to ask him about my brainwaves, you know.
Okay.
Because I noticed that I'm not concentrating as well as I used to, and I was wondering if it was coming from HARP.
Okay.
Could we jam HARP so I could get my concentration back? You know. So anyhow, I didn't make it. I understand it was really interesting, and he explained everything they were doing, and they were really quite open about everything. I mean, there wasn't anything secretive about what they were doing, but it was interesting because it was high power HF transmission and that sort of thing. There's been several of those forums that I wanted to go to, but once again, I was on the air and I couldn't do it. I'm thinking about sending one of my sons in there with a MP3 recorder or something, you know, to catch those things. But anyhow, I don't know. Now, this may be putting you on the spot because this is strategic information.
Sure.
Do you know this year what some of those forums may be?
Well, I happen to have the schedule in front of me. It's also on the web. If you want to go to the web, on our webpage, they're all listed.
Okay.
They are there.
All right. Well, I just tell the audience a little bit about them. Have you gone to very many of those things?
No, I haven't. I'm going to flat out admit it. Because, again, when I get into the positions I'm at, I am busy doing other things. If I had an interest, I would be able to go.
But Dayton's like that. In other words, you know, there are people that are going to go there that are going to do nothing except live in the flea market. And that's all they're going to do. And there's other people that's going to run around on the inside looking at MFJ and RF Specialties and all these different people inside there. They want to see the brand new Flex radio they're wanting to see. You know, and they'll be just on the inside looking at new technology and new things, and they'll be hanging around, like, for example, the ARRL booth and that. And there's folks that'll live in the flea market, and then there are those folks that are there, and they're there specifically because of some interest, like, for example, satellites. They are completely, totally 100% into satellites, and they'll be there strictly for the satellite forums and for all the equipment people that deal with satellite technology.
And also the demonstrations out there and the live satellite feed that they do out in the parking lot out in front of the ball arena.
There you go.
They do that. But now the schedule that you ask for is on the site, and I'll just go through here a little bit if you don't mind.
No, go on. Well, that's what I want you to do, because I want folks to know what's going to be there. There's folks listening that may drive to Dayton just to go to one of those forums.
Okay, well, here we go. The Friday schedule, and this is through Dave Hendricks and Bob Holmes, who have put this together and very, very, and did a lot of work on it. Friday, room one. I'll go down to Friday schedule for room one. Tapper, APRS, D-Star, Antenaforms. Those run from between 9:15 a.m. through 4:45 p.m. Room two. Homeland Security with John Peterson out of D.C. The Evolution of Radio Through the Ages. BalloonSat, Ham Radio and Law, getting antennas up and keeping them up. And County Hunting. And again, the same time frame, 9:15 to 4:45 in the afternoon. That's what all these are on Friday. Room 3, Saturn's Disaster Response Role. Instructors Forum. This is with Carol Perry and her groups. Hams in Space, Fox Hunt, ARDF, Advances in Software-Defined Radios, big new subject. Room 5, QRP Challenge, iOS and Android Rig Control, Kit Building Techniques for Success, Techniques of Best Operators, Young Ladies of YL Forum, Introduction to Digital Mobile Radio, DMR, and the Amateur Radio DMR Networks. That's Friday. Let's go down to Saturday and see what we got here. Again, schedule is 9:15 a.m. through 4:45 in the afternoon. Room 1, Drake Equipment, very popular. Ham Nation, a town hall meeting. Well, we all knew who that is. That's what our good friend out there out of Illinois, Bob Heil, and his group. Contesting, DX Forum. Room 2, 2015 Youth Forum. Fast Scan ATV. Portable HF Antenna Systems in Mars. Room 3, Clandestine Spy Radio Operations during World War II. That would be something I think I might be interested in. A lot of people are. RIDI Contesting, The Doctor is In. Kenwood Legacy Hybrid Equipment. Quarter Century Wireless Association. VHF UHF, my bailiwick. ARRL Member Forum. AMSAT, ARRL Forum. Digital Modes Now and for the Future. Let's go on down to Sunday, which is an abbreviated one that starts 9:15 a.m. through 11:15 before the drawings. Room 1, Aries and System Fusion. Room 2, Roan Towers. Shared Resources, HF Emergency Communications. Interactive Forum for HRD. Engaging youth in ham radio through informal education opportunities, just what we've been talking about. And Room 5, Bicycle Mobile. Now, that is the paintbrush. Look at that. And then, if you go on over to the next one, I'm going off the net now or off the web, they have each day, and if you click on, say, like Friday, and I'll click on it, and you go on down, every single one of them then has who is speaking, what they're going to do, and I'll just pick on the first one here, Tapper. Room 1, 9:15 to 11:15, moderator Scotty Cowling, WA2DFI, past Tapper director and past Tapper vice president, with speakers Steve Bible, Steve Ford, who did a very nice article in QST this past month. Bill Curtis, that's the person I was talking about with the mesh. He's going to be, and Bob Dixon, local people. Hamnet Nish, consider the possibilities. And you go down, Brian Fields, high-speed IP radio, Chris Tesla, White Box Project, Mike Osman, Spectra of Monitoring with Software-Defined Radio. That's just the first one in Tapper in room one. So you can go on down the list, and it goes on and on and on with it, Ted, as to what's there. They did a lot of work to put this together, finally got it up on the web. They were asking for it. So I think they've got themselves a pretty good schedule for this year. Most of them are repeats, but there are some new stuff in there, Ted. Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, I noticed you mentioned a few things, and I thought, well, of course, the subject is a myriad of things. Mm-hmm. But you had one there called Radio Through the Ages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I'm wondering who's putting that on, and I'm wondering what they've got, because that would be extreme. I would think that would be something that...
Let's go back, and now see, you're going to make me do a little more work here, but that's okay. where did I, what day was it on? Let me see what it is. I think it was on Friday. I think it had to do that. I want to go back and see if I can find that for you.
While you're looking that up, I was going to say articles. Well, if you're looking for something, that's when it evades you. You know, it doesn't want to. But I had picked up a book called Shortwave. No, it's called On the Shortwaves. I'm trying to think. On the there's one called Listening to the Shortwaves, one called On the Shortwaves from, I think, I don't know, somewhere like 1920 or something, or maybe before then till 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of pictures of old broadcast facilities and radios and radio ads. And, of course, there's the story that goes behind the whole thing. And I thought it was the most interesting thing. So now I want to get the book that's 1945 to current.
Okay.
You know, which will tell, you know, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story, you know. But I you know, it's so interesting. And I pick up and read this stuff and it's like, you know, it's things you wouldn't even think of, you know, I mean, things that you never knew even happened, you know, and, and now and it's like we did a reenactment of, the 100-year celebration of, Reginald Fessenden doing the, first voice broadcast over radio. Up until then, it had been nothing but CW. And then he decided he figured out a way to modulate it. So they put on an actual program where they played Handel's Largo and they read some verses out of the Bible and whatnot. So all these guys are out at sea and they're tuning in to listen to this, what they was expecting to be a CW station. And here comes all this music and stuff. You know? And so at the 100-year mark, we actually went on the air, and at midnight when this thing took place on New Year's Eve, we duplicated it. You know, we did exactly what he did.
Okay.
And it's kind of a celebration. But, you know, that's all part of, once again, we talked about the history and legacy of radio. And,
right.
You know, one of the things that has really bothered me, and that is, and I know I just say what's on my mind. I'm not directing it at anyone or anything. It's just something. But I, you know, I was so fascinated when I was young about reading about Hiram Percy Maxim and the story of the Wolf Hong. You know, and I mean, I saw this picture of this thing, and I didn't know what it was, and you know, and of course, it's an imaginary torture device to torture hams that they referred to as lids. Okay.
Yeah.
Now we don't really know what the word lid means, or I don't think we know.
I can't tell you either. Nope.
Where that came from, but it, you know, I think we all know when you hear one on the air, you know one. Okay.
Kids and lids.
You know. So, anyways, this is imaginary torture device, and I understand they have one at Newington, Connecticut, inside of a glass case somewhere, okay, along with this other thing called the Ready Snitch, which looks even more threatening than the Wolf Hong. But over the years, I mean, they developed this Wolf Hong ceremony and everything, but they really kind of lost the entire, they call the ceremony the Wolf Hong ceremony, but they have lost the essence of what Hiram Percy Maxim was doing with this thing called the Wolf Hong, you know, and I mean, and what that is, I mean, it was obviously during that period of time was meant to represent, you know, what you would use on some guy that's causing all sorts of problems on the band. He's splattering everywhere. He's playing music. He's talking crazy. He's using foul language and all that. Wolf Hong was supposed to be what the group of hams would take with them, you know, when they go to visit him, and they would just torture the guy to just all to the point of death with it, you know.
Now, should we put this back on the ARRL to come back into this?
Yeah. So it's like, where is this gone? Where is the old man? The anonymous writings. This guy would write about controversial things, and he would point out things that, you know, needed to be corrected in ham radio, and he would sign at the old man, and nobody had any idea who the old man was, you know.
Okay.
I think that was a marvelous time. That was a marvelous thing that this man did. He had imagination. There's an award at the league headquarters for the first amateur that contacts Mars. Okay? In other words, and talk to a Martian.
Oh, boy.
It's there, okay?
Yep.
Isn't that cool?
That is, because, you know, who thinks of things like that?
You know, well, he did, because it was all, you know. And that was just one man with his creativity. And, of course, obviously, the radio station W1AW over there is his original call sign.
Yep.
But I think we lose track of these things. I mean, it's like Wolf Hung. I did an interview with a fellow from the league one time, and I started talking about the Wolf Hung and whatnot, and it was like he was kind of out to lunch. He didn't really know anything about it. And I thought, wait a minute. We got to back up here. So I had thought about reenacting on the air, you know, have a show on maybe like operating procedures or something, you know, real boring subject like operating procedures, you know, and then have a guy on there and you can hear him just acting up and acting a fool on the air. And all of a sudden there's a knock at the door, you know. And you hear these two guys come in, and he's like, oh, no, not that. Oh, my God, it's a Wolf Hung. You know, and they got him, and you hear the guy screaming his lungs out and everything. I think we need stuff like that. You know, we really do. And I know this is way off the track.
Well, that's all right.
But
it's educational for me.
I just thought the Wolf Hung, the Ready Snitch, the Award to Mars, and the Old Man, I thought all that stuff was just, like, super cool. That was, to me, that captured the essence. Because what I found in ham radio, there are some of the most creative people on the planet that are hams. Okay? I mean, totally creative.
I have to agree.
And now some of them are a little socially challenged, you know?
Well.
And if you can get past that, I mean, they, you know, like, you know, I've been known to walk through the flea market with a t-shirt on two sizes too small.
That's your choice.
You know? But the thing is that they're creative people. They're geniuses in so many ways. And creative genius doesn't necessarily have to be technical.
Mm-mm.
You know, it can just be.
The idea people are the ones that start what somebody else may complete.
And I guess I just envy folks like Hiram Percy Maxim. And I think it's important that we don't miss the boat. You know, we understand and get what it was that he was trying to do. And I don't know. That's just my part of it. And why Dayton? Dayton, because it is the largest. You know, it is the largest place, and you can find all kinds of people there in terms of creativity. These forums are just a prime example of that.
They are.
You know, look at all these different subjects. I mean, there isn't. You listen to that and you think, you know, I'd like to know more about that, you know. And If you came to Dayton and did nothing but attend the forums, when you left, you know, you'd be completely challenged. You'd be, you know, like, wow, look at all this stuff.
That's what my message this year when I put it out there. It's at the top of the trifold we sent out as well, because the part of it is to bring this theme on. But the most important thing I say is to go to the forums, and as you can follow your interests, or go to new ones and discover while there. But, you know, it's the kind of thing of what you want to discover. In the meantime, I've found what you wanted to do, and Frank is going to be really on me for not knowing what this was. He gave me it because he's one of the local. In fact, he is the assistant to Michael Coulter this year. But at 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock in room 2 on Friday, The Evolution of Radio Through the Ages is put on by Frank J. Biafor, WS8B, a good friend of ours here. It's based on the first chapter of Antennas by John D. Krause, KHJK, Silent Key. This forum will take the audience from basic scientific discoveries from 600 B.C. to the present. Along the way, many personalities and their respective contributions to the science of radio communication will be discussed. Some demonstrations will be presented, as in any forum, audience participation will be strongly encouraged. And I've heard, and I know Frank, and I'm getting to know him better, but I've heard him put on presentations, and believe me, if you've never heard Frank put on a talk, you will enjoy yourself. He will be very informative, and he's very interactive. So if you have a chance to get to one, maybe you should do that one.
Anyhow, I was just that caught my eye because it's so unusual. In other words, mm-hmm. It's not something, you know, folks expect when they come to Dayton, it's all technical. Everything's technical, but it's not. You know,
nope,
I mean,
not that one.
And if not, you bring a female in and watch her run around looking at all the tables with jewelry on them, and
yep.
on all kinds of other things that,
well, crafts and things of that sort. And
right.
That's why, you know, it's something that we try to do. And again, then we'll get a little bit of feedback on that. Why do you let that in there? Listen, this is for family. It's not just for you guys and all that stuff, which, yes, that is our main focus and things of that sort, but Don't you want your whole family to enjoy this?
I want to, once again, I'm going to switch gears on you here.
Sure, go ahead.
Let's talk about kids.
Sure.
I have a grandson that has been to Dayton 3-4 years in a row here. Every year he goes off, and I don't know what they do, but they, you know, he comes back with something he soldered maybe a little kit of some kind of something they've built, and it seems like they're just totally. And he's made several friends. He's made several friends over there. Met kids that he stays in contact with all year long that are obviously sons of Hams. So tell us a little bit about the kids program, because I think that's one of the coolest things about Dayton. Person, you come, and it's not like it's a daycare center. It's a place where your kid can go and sit, or kids can go and sit and learn and participate. They had their fox hunt, and oh, man, I'm telling you.
Yep.
They just knock it out of the ballpark.
Yep, and this is, of course, well, the ARRL puts on probably one of the best things, I think, as far as testing and doing that kind of stuff. But one thing was brought up by one of our ARRL liaison persons, Mark Tessner. He's going to do something a little bit, not quite like a fox hunt, but it's going to be like a scavenger hunt. And what we're going to do this year is hand out a sheet of paper and have the youngsters go out and identify, again, these people in these yellow shirts, and there's going to be a list of who these people are, and they try to find them and go up and ask the person, are you so-and-so and such? In my case, would they walk up and says, are you Jim? And he'd IDS. And I'd answer yes. And then they would mark the sheet and go on and try to find the next one. This is to give them recognition, probably, as you say, a little bit of getting out of the shell, not being timid enough, to not say anything, be able to go. Of course, you're going to have some kids that are just absolutely pretty rambunctious when it comes to this. But that's a part of what they're doing there. Another thing is, of course, the kit building and learning about what you are and what's going on in the amateur world. Bringing them up into the Arduino-type things and the solid-state stuff and the software-defined radio equipment, things of this sort. TechFest down here at Sinclair just a couple of months ago pointed out the interest we have in that, in the technology. So kids themselves, and when you speak kids, they're going to be all age groups. I can't pick an age. I can't pinpoint one age group to another that has any more interest than another, because it just happens to be what is the degree, like your grandson. He may come up and say, well, geez, Grandpa, I don't really know what I want to look at. Where am I going to find this? You may or may not be able to tell them, but I'll bet you another kid will be able to tell them.
There you go.
Is the part that I think is kind of nice, that they kind of interact with themselves. The interest on their faces when I walk around and look at what they're doing. Now, the programs themselves that's going on, I have to admit, I do not know exactly all of what they're going to be doing. Another thing I'd like them to do, if they could, and this can be all ages, special event station. Do you know what that is?
Oh, you're asking me if I know what a special event station is? Oh, yeah, I know what a special event station is.
Okay, so have you ever been over to ours?
No, I haven't, because I'm stuck in a booth.
Well, now see, here's something else. You could say, if you want to be on the air while you're there, we'll say that that young person just went over and took the exams over at Bayshore Church, where we have our exams this year and last year. They just got their license, they upgraded. Come on over. You've got your brand-new ticket. Come on over and get on the air in Ball Arena, not that far away from where you're at. It's right over by the entrance door to Ball Arena, door one, by ARRL, right in that area. Special event station put on by one of our committees, the Hamvention Committee. They have HF radios there. We have antennas set up outside on the antenna trailer from PNR Communications. They can get on the air right there. If you do have QSL cards, you can bring those and pin them up on the side curtains that we have there on the dividers. So that's another thing I encourage children to do. Get into that station. Get on the air. Listen to what's going on. Don't be timid. Get in there and do that kind of stuff. But going back to your original question, what about the kids' programs, the children's forums and stuff like that? They have the forum that is in there. When that forum is on, one of the things we also are doing live streaming on Ustream. And Jim Simpson is heading that up, who is going to be coming around with it. He's going to have two cameras this year to run around and do this, so we can do live streaming. And the video will also be archived, so you can go back and see some of this stuff. So the people that haven't had the chance to be here to get online and do that. Here we go again, back to our computers, don't we? Getting online. This is something that we want to encourage them to come to see it yourself. Come to see what's going on. But I didn't answer your whole question, and I'm sorry I don't have any more information than that. And shame on me! I should take a noodle.
Well, no. You can't know everything about everything. But you know, what you can do is what you just did was talk about the program that goes on there for kids, and
yep.
And I have a chance to mention it too, and to encourage parents to bring those kids with you. Don't leave them at home. Bring them.
Ooh, you know.
And this could be a reason why. Someone who is not necessarily really interested in doing anything ham wise, but they do seem to have a problem with their kid. Bring your kid. You don't know what kind of an interest. Maybe just all of a sudden that'll resonate with that kid, and he just wants to get involved in something regarding amateur radio, which is a life changing event for a lot of folks, a lot of young people. It's a life changing event. It's not just something. It's not just a hobby, you know.
Right.
So that's the other thing. The other thing I was gonna bring up to you too, to talk about just briefly, and that is, well, not necessarily briefly, but just want to talk about it. And that is, Bob Allison is always there, and he's with the ARRL, and he's involved with they take pieces of equipment in and they. Analyze the things, you know, or tell you which one, how good it is, how it performs and whatnot. And they've always got this big display there. And I think last year and the year before, he came over to the booth and brought with him an actual satellite module that is a communication satellite, is what it is. I mean, a little bitty thing about the size of about four or five times the size of a Rubik's Cube.
Okay. Really? Okay.
And sat it down on the table, and he said, this is a satellite. You know, this is a satellite transceiver. This is whatever it is, you know. And he told me what the name was and all that kind of stuff, and I looked at it, and I said, this is really small. And, but we could hold it in your hands, you know, but that's actually what's up there, you know, that we're talking to. And they usually at their booth, they have all kinds of things like that. So I don't know, you're maybe not familiar with Bob Allison, but he's there every year with the league, and I've yet to see a year where he's not there. But if you come to Dayton, you need to look him up and that booth up, because it's research and development, I think, is the area that they're in, where they look at all the new radios that come out, all the new gadgets that come out, and they kind of analyze them and explain them. And so I guess you don't know Bob then, obviously.
No, I don't. I can't speak to that, and I'm sorry I can't know that stuff. But the only thing I can add into there, which is a very familiar name, is Carol Perry, WB2MGP, who brings in her whole group of people that go into a lot, and she's dedicated, of course, to all of the different youth groups that come in and the way that they educate them into the amateur radio itself and start out. She is a person that is very personable. It's always nice seeing her. Again, I don't have a whole lot of chance to go ahead and visit with them a whole lot. But the other thing is, when you start having with youth forums and stuff like that, they have a lot of things that are going to be probably newer each year, but the same old thing, because you have to keep on going into it and doing a lot of stuff. Now, I did find one thing, kit building techniques for success. Now, that's by Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB, and whether or not kids want to get into that or not, that is an area, I think, Ted, where if you could go back into, say, like when you and I started on some of this stuff, we didn't necessarily have kits. We probably had the hands-on stuff we found either from hand-me-downs from people that were in your area, or you went to a ham fest or a hamvention like here, picked that stuff up and went home. The kit-building stuff that you have now, and even getting online to do some of this stuff for instructions, might be something they'd be interested in as far as children goes. Do you think anything like that would be viable for them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Joe Eisenberg comes by the booth all the time, and he has that cat in the hat.
Yeah,
thing on,
yeah.
You know? And then, of course, we'll see him somewhere else and say, where's the hat? You know?
Yep.
I only wear that at Dayton.
That's right. I've only seen – well – yeah, that's right. He was at. He came over to Dara and gave a speech at a a presentation at one of our membership meetings, and he didn't have the hat on. He was asked by the same thing, where's the hat? I said, well, that's a special hat. That only comes with me when I come out there to do that stuff, which is good. That is good.
You know, the thing is Joe does all of the writing, does writing for CQ Magazine.
Yes.
And of course, it's all on the most popular kits and the best kits and all that. Boy, if you want to ask somebody that knows, ask him. He'll tell you.
Yep.
But he comes over and sits down and talks with us. And the thing that's really cool is, of course, he's working with kits overall, not just with kids. And so a lot of older people, all of us old people, go and ask him about kits and whatnot. But he's a brain when it comes to that. But he's there every year.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the kids are concerned, I think that's probably the reason why he wears the hat, because it attracts attention and whatnot. I'll have to ask him one year, because I don't think I've ever, I've just kind of accepted the hat, never asked him why he wears it.
I didn't know he was. The first time I saw him, I thought, well, okay, I see Sam Anderson running around with his little tower hat on, his little 220 antenna on that hard hat. Well, then you see, Joe come along with that tall hat, and sometimes along with, there's a lady that goes with him and has her hair wound up in an antenna in her hairdo.
Yeah, there you go.
And I thought, this is kind of interesting stuff, but it almost can be different. Now, while you were talking there a little bit, I did go back into the forums, and on the, let me see what schedule this is. This is for Sunday, on Sunday after, and then in here it's going to be... Me back down to it. At 10:30 to 11:30, room 3, engaging youth in ham radio through informal education opportunities. Larry Kendall, K6NDL, as instructor, ARRL's Teachers Institute on Wireless Technology. So if he goes into this, might be something that the children or the young people will want to get into. Go ahead on the on-site, online here. I won't go into it, read the whole thing, and kind of bore people. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't, but this will kind of force them to go online and take a look at our website to read what's going on in all these different forums to get some of the information on the questions you're asking right now, Ted.
You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. I'm Ted Randall, and our guest is Jim Teterman, N8IDS, the chair of the Dayton Hamvention. We'll be back right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. Our guest is Jim Teeterman, N8IDS. He is the chairman of the Dayton Hamvention this year for 2015 and 2016. Let's get back to Jim. Yeah, and all, if you can't remember the website, all you have to do is go to Google and put in Dayton Hamvention.
I just have to put hamvention.org in. That's all you need to do, Ted. Hamvention.org.
And Google will find it for you.
Sure. They'll all, however you put it in. Go into it, and it's a brand new website. That was one of my projects this year, and I have to take the whipping for it for not being ready in time for a lot of things to be on there. But it was time for an improvement. So I think if you haven't been on the web, go visit it, take a look, see what you think, make your comments. But I think you'll enjoy the experience.
I was going to say, this year, of course, like every year, W5KUB Tom Medlin will be running around with, I call him the helmet cam guy.
But I'll
tell you, on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock, he has started a streaming broadcast from his location. And we simulcast it on the shortwave. We simulcast it on WTWW on 9930. Mm-hmm. And that's every Tuesday at 8 o'clock.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of stuff on there about the Dayton Hamvention.
Well, Mike Coulter and I were asked to come on, and he and I did go on with him one night from Bell Fountain Road. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking with Ted. You're Ted. Listen to me here.
Tom.
with Tom. And I've met him before years back. I had to take a reporter down from one of the local TV stations down to his tent when he was out in the flea market. Of course, now he's inside and outside both. So I'm so darn glad that he's going to be there. And again, this year, as you well know, if you've been reading about it, he's a special achievement winner for this year. Tom Medlin, W5KUB, is going to be receiving the awards at the award banquet again. And I'd like to, if I could, just go through the Amateur of the Year and all that stuff and the special event, the award winners for this year. Again, going back to the Amateur of the Year, Tim Duffy, K3LR, and back down to Special Achievement for Tom Medlin, W5KUB. Then we go down to Technical Excellence, Reverend George Dobbs, G3RJV. And then Club of the Year, which we've started here a few years back, is the Orlando Amateur Radio Club, Orlando, Florida. So that's our award winners for this year, Ted.
Very good. Very good. And Tom is, that's overdue with this man. I'm telling you, he has worked so hard over the years, and nobody knows any better how hard it is to bring in a truckload of equipment and set up a complete radio studio like we have to do, and then man the thing during the entire hamvention and be on the air. Ours is different than his in that, you know, we're dealing with shortwave transmitters that are on live, so we have to allocate time and whatnot. But with him, you know, he moves around. I mean, he takes this table with him, and he goes everywhere that he goes. He goes out in the flea market. He goes everywhere. And people all over the place can come to watch the hamvention over the internet, you know. And of course now, and we have them now where they're listening to the shortwave broadcast, and they're also watching Tom, so they get an overdose of Dayton.
Well, that's okay.
I think it's kind of cool. What's really cool though is when he comes to our booth and we combine forces, and I keep telling people to go to w5kub.com. And the people that are, then they show up in his chat room from all over the world, you know, giving signal reports and whatnot. So so that was the synergy, I think, that really sparked this thing for Tuesday nights. Because we carry the whole thing on shortwave, and I join him with the shows on Tuesday night, and then he provides obviously the video portion of it and the guests and whatnot. So it's kind of a cool combination, you know. So anyway, I don't know, who knows what we'll wind up. We're both on the air during Dayton, and that might be a cool thing, I think, at some point to maybe capture parts of his audio as he moves around, you know.
Well, it could be. Now, how did you guys get started with this? I had to ask that question. I'll turn the tables a little bit. How did you get started in doing what you're doing with this?
Well, I'll refer you to my publicist, and they'll set up a time when I can. I'm just kidding.
That's okay. Yeah. Up to you.
No, with QSO, I guess I was just sitting there with the shortwave station one day, and I noticed that a lot of the mailbag programs have disappeared, and all these different programming things that were on shortwave, and what was left on shortwave was dreadfully boring. You know, people droning on about this, reported this station, and this one reported this. And I said, we got to put something on that's fun, you know, something where people just talk, and we can just roll up sleeves and have a big time talking about ham radio. So we just put a show together, and I didn't even have a name for it, you know, and we ran that for 2 or 3 weeks. And and the response was phenomenal. We just got people everywhere. And the next thing we did, we named it QSO. I thought, well, that's what it is. It's a QSO, you know.
Yep.
And, man, how many years ago was that? I don't know. We've been doing this a long time. Let's see. The league gave us several of those Bill Leonard Media Awards. I think that started around 2008, you know.
Okay.
You know, and that's something they ought to give to Tom Medlin, for goodness sakes. I mean, because he's, you know, been a pioneer in taking the ham radio world to the world too, you know. So, but anyways, boy, I don't know when I don't know what year. I'd have to ask somebody else that's got a bigger brain than mine. I mean, we go back a ways, because I know we've been doing Dayton for what, 7, 8 years, 8, 9 years maybe. I don't
know. Okay, good.
You know, doing the live broadcast from there. Yep. But that's how I got started. But it was almost like a kickstart thing. Once you hit the kickstart, boy, it took off on its own, you know. And the next thing you know, we've just got all kinds of listeners. We did a little thing at Christmas, and I'm getting close on time here. I'll make this quick.
Sure.
The craziest stuff comes out of when you don't expect it. We were testing a transmitter, and I put some Christmas music on for, you know, during the test, and all of a sudden I started getting emails. Then I had two guys sending me pictures of their old antique shortwave radios.
Oh, really?
And I thought, huh. So we put Christmas music on 24/7 on that transmitter through the Christmas season, and we ran these promos that said, send us a picture of your shortwave radio.
Really?
We want to see your shortwave, and we want to get it to the point where the shortwave radio replaces the electric train under the Christmas tree or beside.
Bingo. Yeah.
So do you know how many pictures we wound up getting?
I couldn't take a guess.
8,000 plus pictures. Yes.
And there's the magic of what you do and how we can communicate today to do that.
And these guys, these aren't the radios they normally listen on. These are their prize possessions that they've got stowed away, and they bring it out at Christmas time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, can you imagine being in your living room and seeing a stand-up Zenith or a stand-up Gruno and hearing Bing Crosby sing White Christmas over that thing? Oh, man. I mean, it's like, it, you know, the electric train hasn't got a chance.
Nope. It's something that, yeah, you like to play with it, but it's a heartstring, because I go back to the same thing, Ted, with my grandfather. He had, I believe, a Philco. And I can remember the foreign broadcast stuff that I've listened to, and he lived in a little town out of Iron Mountain up in Florence, right across the Wisconsin border. And he was up in this big room upstairs after my grandmother died, and he used to go up there and entertain himself listening to it. So I'd go up and visit with him. Mom and Dad would be doing something else, and I'd be here, and I'd sit down right in front of that big, huge speaker. And like you say, that resonance, it just hits you in the chest.
Oh, yeah.
And these deep-voiced people from over in Europe or every other place, and I didn't understand some of the languages, and our family is Swedish. So he would tune into somewhere over in Sweden and start listening to this, and he would interpret, listen to me. I can't even say the word. Anyway, he'd tell me what they're saying as the interpreter. And it got to be where that was my bonding with my grandfather. Now, why do I listen to him? I remember that so much. I learned a lot of things from my grandfather and father and aunts and uncles, but I remember that so much, and there's a tie to the radio stuff. Not that I knew I was going to be into amateur radio then, but I always enjoyed music. I always enjoyed information and just listening to things. That was just the era I grew up in. You know, you're born in 42. You come up through this, and by the time you're 6, 7 years old, it's after the war, things are starting to really roll. You still had time to sit and listen to things and take time with family. That was an important part of what I'm doing. But I digress. Go ahead, Ted.
It sets up that big radio sitting there, just sets you up for the magic that's to come, you know, and I think in a lot of cases, I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes our young people are overloaded with too much technology, that they don't really ever get the magic part of anything, you know, because
Look at the stance they have. Do you ever see those things? They're cartoons, but it's not funny. I did a stint up at our airport here. I used to drive bus for a car rental company, and I'd watch these people coming out of the airport door to come out and either meet their parties or come over to the bus to go get a rental car. They aren't even looking up. They're looking down at their blasted phones or their iPods or whatever. Walking into people or walking into objects or walking right off the curb. And why is this going on? You know, pay attention to what's going around you. But it's just a culture difference of thinking, gosh, get these people to look around.
We can have a whole show on this. Yeah. Believe me, it's one of my pet peeves. Tell my grandson.
Sorry to say, but that's all the time we've got for QSO today. Our guest has been Jim Teeterman, N8IDS, the chairman of the Dayton Hamvention for 2015 and 2016. I want to say thank you for listening. 73. We'll be back next week, same time and same station with QSO.